From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Friday, the government of Muammar Gaddafi announced a ceasefire a day after a UN Security Council resolution called for a no-fly zone and military intervention to protect Libyan civilians. Whether this will open up the country is not clear. Throughout the month-long Libyan uprising, Gaddafi has shown no tolerance for journalism. Last week, Libyan authorities detained and beat reporters from BBC Arabic and subjected them to mock executions. A few days after their release, Al Jazeera cameraman Ali Hassan Al-Jaber was killed in an apparent ambush. Speaking on state radio Thursday, Gaddafi called on Libyans to attack press vehicles and destroy broadcast stations. Yet Libya's government announced Friday that it would be releasing four New York Times reporters who disappeared earlier this week. In the chaos, some major news organizations are pulling the reporters out of Libya, which could lead to a near-total information vacuum. Ben Wiedemann is CNN's senior international correspondent and the first American journalist to enter Libya when the protests began in February. He and his crew have been leery of the government from the start.
We entered the country technically illegally without visas, and the government made it very clear from the beginning that we would be considered outlaws and, in fact, cooperating with Al-Qaeda. Otherwise, certainly the threat of bombing by jets of the Libyan Air Force was ever present whenever you were very close to the front. It was fairly chaotic in the sense that this was not, at least on the rebel side, a rational, organized military force. They were just really a bunch of guys who got guns and jumped into their cars and drove to the front. Now, I've seen something like that in Sierra Leone and in Afghanistan and various other places, but somehow it seemed a bit more immediate because, unlike in Afghanistan or Sierra Leone, there was nowhere to hide. You felt very exposed on the highway in the desert.
For the last couple of weeks, you've been spending time with the anti-Gaddafi forces, but I'm wondering if before that you were at all harassed by Gaddafi's state security people, street thugs, anybody who was unhappy about your presence there.
I was only in eastern Libya on this particular visit, and if anything, I was overwhelmed by friendliness, by gratitude. They were incredibly appreciative. The journalists were there, and in fact, I was pelted, but I was pelted with candy and dates when we entered Benghazi. There was nothing but a warm welcome there. We know that there was a threat that the Gaddafi regime had sent out people specifically to tail journalists, and in some cases, to kill them. And I think that's what happened to Hassan Ali Jaber of Jazeera, the cameraman who was killed outside of Benghazi the other day.
You've been in the east with the rebel forces. Tell me what you're hearing from colleagues in Tripoli and further west, where Gaddafi forces can keep a closer eye on them.
We're hearing about the plainclothes policemen going from door to door in Tripoli, looking for people who had contact with the foreign media, who may have passed information to the foreign media. There's a real worry that if Muammar Gaddafi is able to reestablish his control, lots of people are going to be rounded up and many will be executed.
And the journalists themselves trying to report in Tripoli, are they being hampered in filing outside of the country?
Well, they're having a very difficult time. My colleague Nick Robertson, who's in Tripoli, his producer was kicked around by plainclothed Libyan security. It's a very difficult situation. They can file whatever they want, but they have so little freedom of movement that it's very difficult to actually get any solid information. They're just fed a lot of propaganda. Fortunately, they're professionals and they're not eating it.
Gaddafi himself had made various paranoid and preposterous accusations that the Western press were agents of, as you said, Al-Qaeda, and also were substantially behind the unrest. You know, in a certain way, I guess that's true, because foreign press coverage was, in many ways, the oxygen behind the flames of insurrection. It sort of emboldened people to take to the streets, knowing that the story would be told outside of Libya. To what extent did the press become kind of part of the story it was covering?
really the acts that required the most courage, the most bravery, were the ones at the very beginning, the people who came out and protested against the regime. And that was at a time when there was no media whatsoever there to cover it. The media showed up a week or so after the rebellion began, and I don't really think that we did provide the oxygen for the rebellion, because the rebellion was based not upon media coverage, but a good deal of unhappiness and dissatisfaction with the lot of people in Libya.
What happens, though, as journalists are leaving the country, does it leave behind the sense that the efforts of the Libyan protesters are invisible to the outside world?
The difference, I think, is that whereas before, the people in eastern Libya were unknowns. They were phone numbers we were getting. We were calling them up and getting information from them. Now we know them much better. The familiarity of the media with the situation on the ground is much better. So I think even if it happened that there were no journalists left in eastern Libya, I think the amount of information and the quality of the information coming out of there would be much better than it was before.
All right, Ben. Enjoy your few days of R&R, and we hope to speak to you again.
I look forward to it.
Ben Wiedemann is the senior international correspondent for CNN. This week, Japanese Prime Minister Naoto Kan sat down with the executives of Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, the utility in charge of the nuclear power plants in Japan, and demanded to know what the hell is going on. He was speaking for a nation that had been bombarded by confusing reports and conflicting information since the nuclear crisis first began last weekend. Even the institutionally polite Japanese media have reacted harshly to TEPCO's mismanaged press conferences, and on Tuesday, the government announced the formation of a joint crisis headquarters inside the utility company. Michael Chuchek is a political analyst and research associate with the MIT Center for International Studies, who has lived in Tokyo since 1994. He says that while confusing information about radiation levels has worried many in Japan, TEPCO has compounded the anxiety with its mismanagement of rolling blackouts.
Tonight, for example, TEPCO announced a cutoff of electrical supplies and caused yet another panic in the capital. Everybody tried to rush home before supposedly all the train lines were going to lose power. Lo and behold, the train lines didn't lose power, but there were lines of thousands of people trying to get onto trains and try to get home before the power outage that never arrived. In their most egregious fault, they turned off the power to one city that had been hit by the tsunami. The governor of the prefecture called TEPCO people into his office, and he berated them. This has dashed anybody's sense that TEPCO knows what it's doing. Unfortunately, TEPCO employees are the only people on the ground at the nuclear site. There's no one else to turn to for information.
So the nation is depending for its survival on the very institution it trusts the least.
That's a very good way of putting it.
Tell me about the media. Newspapers and TV tend to be polite, if not deferential, to institutional subjects. Has their treatment of TEPCO evolved during this crisis?
The reporters at the press conferences have been very sharp in their questioning and, in fact, dismissive of the information or misinformation that they're receiving. However, that doesn't always make it out to the public. Media institutions here in Japan are controlled by a media law that requires balance in the way reporting is done. It's defined by bureaucrats in the government, and if you say something that the government doesn't like, it can affect your ability to continue to do reporting. So they are deferential, not as a cultural matter, but because there is a legal requirement.
In the States, in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, Anderson Cooper of CNN famously became impatient with government's failures and acted out on air in frustration. Has there been any such moment in the Japanese press?
The most influential newscaster in the morning is a man named Mino Monta. He, after hearing one TEPCO press conference, just lost it and said, you know, They should just stop having press conferences. If they're telling us things that we don't understand or they have nothing to tell us, they should not have these events. That is a major breaking point because he is an extremely influential man. And it indicates that it's okay to no longer trust TEPCO.
So now that the government has seized control of the public information operation, I wonder about how much trust the government commands among the Japanese population.
What they've done is a double-edged sword. By taking over TEPCO news releases, they unfortunately take on TEPCO's worst attributes as well. And that can hurt the government. But the government really didn't have much of a choice. It was finding out things from the news media before it was being told by TEPCO.
As we speak on Thursday, the fuel rods, the sources of the radiation, reportedly are completely exposed. And yet the government has not changed its recommendation for evacuation beyond the 20-kilometer zone that it previously established. The United States is telling its nationals in the area who live within 50 kilometers of the plant to get the hell out. What does that tell you about the government's predicament?
The United States' recommendation to its citizens to stay 50 kilometers away from the plants, it's on a voluntary basis. The Japanese government's two rings of defense, one where the 20-kilometer ring, which is completely evacuated, and the 20 to 30-kilometer range where the recommendation is don't leave your home, and if you wear clothes outside, don't bring them into the house. Those are mandatory. Currently, news organizations are doing things like informing people on how to live an irradiated life, what you should wear, what you should do with vegetables and fruit. There's a sense of there's no point in being panicked because there's no place where we can go.
Michael, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Michael Chuchek is a political analyst and research associate at the MIT Center for International Studies in Tokyo.
Coming up, bias. Who's got it? And Ira Glass returns.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the House of Representatives passed, largely along party lines, a bill that would bar public radio stations from using federal money to buy national programming from NPR or other sources. It was called a political stunt by one House Democrat. Another sponsored an unsuccessful amendment to bar the government from buying ad time on Fox News. That was this week. Last week, after a sting video emerged showing an NPR fundraiser saying disparaging things about the Tea Party, Republican opposition to public radio heated up, and Ira Glass, host of This American Life, challenged us to tackle what had been oft-charged but rarely addressed by public radio, that it is biased.
On the Media, you are the perfect vehicle for this. You were made for this purpose, to measure the political bias of public radio. It needs to be done. You are the only ones. You are the ones best positioned of everyone in the country, in the public radio system, in the world, to do this mission. And I hand it to you. It's an urgent mission, and it needs to be done and done beautifully.
What if the answer is yes, NPR has a left-wing bias?
It's not going to be yes.
This got quite the reaction. We've heard from many, many of you, and so has This American Life. So, at the risk of being overly self-absorbed, we've decided to deal with the question both this week and next. As we waded in, we realized it's incredibly complicated. Look no further than the terms themselves. What is bias? What do we mean when we invoke the word liberal? And even defining NPR is fraught. First up, bias. It's a moving target. In his 1986 book, The Uncensored War, communications professor Daniel Hallin drew a simple diagram depicting three spheres in journalism. They're called Hallin's spheres. Picture a donut. The hole in the donut is the sphere of consensus. And here are issues and views we can all agree on. Democracy is good, slavery is bad, all men are created equal. Here, truths are self-evident, and journalists don't feel the need to be objective. No, that's reserved for the donut itself, the sphere of legitimate controversy. Here's where the bulk of journalism takes place. Gun control, interest rates, budget matters, and abortion. Issues on which reasonable people can disagree and where journalists are obliged to present both sides. Outside the donut lies the sphere of deviance, limbo, where viewpoints are deemed unworthy of debate. The pro-pedophilia position, for example, does not get a hearing in mainstream media. But Hallin created his spheres in the 1980s, before Fox News and MSNBC, the rise of talk radio and the blogosphere. Certain views that a generation ago would have been relegated to the sphere of deviance, for example, questioning the birth certificate of the President of the United States, Hallin says have now forced their way onto the donut.
When I made my diagram, there was only one set of spheres, let's say, and everybody kind of agreed on what they were. The boundaries might get fuzzy. But now I think our media have become fragmented and pluralized so that you have different sub-communities that have different ideas of where the boundaries lie, right? So a generation ago that questions whether Obama can legitimately be president, this would have been rejected both by elites in Washington of both parties and by the media as just absolutely outside the proper bounds of political debate. And it would have been excluded. Today, there's just a lot less consensus.
So Hallin's donut has been blasted into crumbs by a confluence of voices. That's not necessarily a bad thing. But where does that leave NPR?
NPR, like actually quite a few of the mainstream news organizations in the U.S., I would say still adheres to the old-style journalism that tries to stick to the center and tell both sides. But I think that this is a period in which it's harder to do. I think it's much more difficult to legitimize.
What do you mean it's more difficult to legitimize?
Well, you could convince people that you were, in fact, being neutral by sticking to a point in the center between Republicans and Democrats and giving them both a hearing in an earlier period. Nowadays, that just doesn't work as well because different segments of the population have different ideas of where the center really is, of what's a legitimate political point of view. So I think that all of the news organizations that try and stick to the old-fashioned patterns of journalistic professionalism, they're all a little bit on the defensive.
How do you think mainstream journalists should respond to the fuzziness of the sphere of consensus, the sphere of legitimate debate, and the sphere of deviance, that which should not be discussed?
At what point would we decide that global warming is not really a legitimate subject of controversy anymore? Because the truth is, within scientific communities, it's not. Within the political public sphere, there's still a big controversy about it. And that is somewhat troubling, that gap. You know, in many cases, I think it's going to be the right decision for journalists to say, we're aware that the science says that there's not a controversy here, and we're going to refuse to treat this part of it as though it were controversial. I think that that's a responsible decision. I think it's politically risky as well.
Daniel Hallin teaches at the University of California, San Diego. Based on the remark we just heard, he'll be labeled by some as a liberal. The word is applied broadly now to big L liberal politics and small L liberal values, even liberal science, to the point where the word liberal itself means almost nothing. And what does NPR mean? For most people, NPR is whatever they hear when they tune into public radio. But NPR itself produces or editorially oversees very little of that content. It's directly responsible for Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the weekend equivalent of those shows, and Talk of the Nation. It also distributes shows produced elsewhere, On the Media, Diane Rehm, Fresh Air, and so on. And then there are the shows that NPR neither produces nor distributes that are among public radio's most popular: This American Life, Marketplace, A Prairie Home Companion. And finally, there are the local shows produced by public radio stations everywhere. But does it even matter when most of the bias debate coalesces around federal support, the bulk of which goes to stations? Sam Negus is a libertarian evangelical Christian who listens to a lot of public radio. He wrote Ira that he values it, but he won't support it because of some crucial biases he hears. We asked him on to explain, and we had Ira back, too, to hear what irks Negus the most.
The political example that I gave you that stuck out in my mind most recently was from the Friday News Roundup this past Friday.
This is a Diane Rehm show.
They were a couple of journalists, and they started the show talking about the labor situation, obviously Wisconsin and Indiana. So the panelists were talking, and one of the first observations that one of the guests made was that the situation in Wisconsin would probably galvanize the American labor movement. And the tone of her voice told me very clearly that she was thrilled by that, which she has every right to be. What I didn't hear was another guest who shared my ideological concerns with the overarching goals of labor unionism. There was nobody there, I felt, speaking for the electorate of Wisconsin. The people of Wisconsin went to the polls and they returned the Wisconsin Democrats as the minority in the Senate. And what happens when you're in the minority is bills get passed that you don't like. That's democracy, you know.
So, Sam, can I ask you, I don't hear many of the talk shows during the day. Most of the public radio listening I hear is of the news programs. And so this morning's Morning Edition, here's what I heard. They had a lead story which was from Japan about what it's like right now for the people in the most devastated areas. Then there was a story from here in the U.S. which talked about nuclear power plants in the United States. And surprisingly, we're not really building many anymore because natural gas is so much cheaper. And then there's a story from Bahrain and an on-the-ground story about what's happening there. Then a story about Haley Barbour's run for the presidential nomination and his background and some very convincing things, I thought, that he said from the stump, and audiences saying what a great impression he made, and a summary of one early problem in his campaign. And then there was a report on new laws to restrict abortion, and that had a very standard sort of TikTok pro-choice, anti-abortion sides, of that thing. And, mm-hmm. and it just seemed very, very straight to me. It seemed like mainstream news coverage, very factual, a lot of on-the-ground reporting, a lot of context. And I guess the thing that I'm wondering is, do you feel like the things that you're hearing that are making you wince, is it really on the fringes? Is it really just now and then? Because to me, when I think of public radio, I feel like overwhelmingly it is like what I heard this morning on Morning Edition.
Right. Okay. So I listened to the same report this morning. I particularly listened to the abortion discussion because I knew we were going to be having this conversation this afternoon. And I thought, okay, let's see what they're saying here. You know, and I did think it was fair and balanced. There is a difference between NPR's kind of news coverage and the editorial stuff. I do see that bias less obviously in the news coverage. Maybe the best way to explain it would just be that there are assumptions. You can explain facts, but the way that you state facts or the way that you structure them, sometimes it's more than others, and sometimes it's because I'm sensitive. I'm aware of my own biases too. I understand sometimes I'm reading into questions hostility that isn't there, but sometimes it's definitely there. And I'll give you an example that my wife and I have kind of joked about a couple of times. We remember very clearly the morning after the 2006 midterms when the Democrats took back the House. It was just obvious that the anchors on Morning Edition and the other shows that followed were happy. You can't hide when you're happy, right?
Sam, another thing that you wrote me about was more of a cultural bias, and you wrote about something that you heard on Fresh Air.
Okay, so it was Good Friday, I think maybe 2 years ago. I turned on NPR. They had the radio on. It's almost always on to NPR if we're in the car. Terry Gross's show, Fresh Air, was on, and her guest was a co-founder of the Jesus Seminar. And the Jesus Seminar, for anyone who isn't familiar, the short version of what they believe that's offensive to me as an evangelical Christian is that Jesus Christ did not rise from the dead as a bodily historical fact, but that that's a kind of spiritual metaphor. Now, he can believe that. That's fine. I'm not about forcing anyone to believe anything. The point was that a co-founder of the Jesus Seminar was on that show on a national platform for a solid hour, unopposed. It wasn't a panel. That sent a message to me. And I think the thing that I said in my email, and maybe this is what stuck out to you, Ira, 99.99%, almost everybody in the world, and everybody in the history of the world since the time of Christ to now, who would identify themselves as a Christian, would be deeply offended and upset by this perspective, and moreover, wouldn't consider this person to be a Christian.
Because he doesn't believe in the literal resurrection.
Christ himself said, you want to know who I am? The resurrection is who I am. I'm going to be killed, I'll be in the grave, and then I will rise again. That's the heart of my religion, which is the heart of my being. It's everything I am. And I don't mind that that person was on NPR. But I've listened to NPR for years, and I've heard many, many religious shows. And I have not once got to the end of the show and thought, man, I am so glad that that guy was on there. He said exactly what I wanted him to say.
So I understand that you're saying that there's this question of tone that you hear all the time on all the shows, the news shows and the non-news shows, the more the talk shows. But do you think the information that you're getting by and large is reliable?
Yeah, I wouldn't be listening to Morning Edition to get my daily news while I eat my Cheerios and have a cup of coffee if I didn't. I think it's excellent. But, I mean, heck, you wouldn't have gotten so many emails saying the same thing if I was completely barking up the wrong tree, would you?
Possibly, because constantly we get arguments that NPR is bending over backwards the other way from our mail. It happens all the time, which is why we'd like you to keep a diary. Would you do that for us?
Sure.
Oh, poor guy. He just wrote a letter and now he's being dragged into a multi-week project.
No, Ira, I'm
just 1 week.
It's fine. I'm thrilled to actually have a response. I'm thrilled to think that someone within the organization cares.
As you just heard, Sam Negus finds much of the programming on public radio excellent. He listens at the breakfast table. He listens in the car. But he won't support it because of those moments he just described. But how to judge the service as a whole? It probably can't be done, but we said we'd try, so we called Tom Rosensteel, founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism at the Pew Research Center. He quantifies media for a living. So I asked him if he found measuring bias to be a particularly sticky wicket.
Yes, and there's all kinds of academic literature that we've looked at that suggests that that wicket is really very sticky. First of all, when you are going to say that something's biased, you have to have some sense then of what would be unbiased, what would be perfectly accurate on some subject. Even evaluating whether the coverage of a candidate is too positive or negative, you have to take into account, well, how is that candidate doing in the polls? A candidate that's winning an election is going to have more positive coverage than a candidate that's losing an election. And you have to somehow control for that. One other interesting thing on this question of journalistic bias that can be unconscious. The Philadelphia Inquirer a few years ago did a study because they were being attacked by pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli members of the community. So they had LSU do a study of their coverage of the Middle East. And the research came back and said, you do have a bias in your coverage. It's a pro-peace bias. You favor whichever side at any given moment is looking for a ceasefire. The problem with that is that the people who are advocating violence at any given moment are doing so for a reason. They're not crazy necessarily. They might be wrong or they might be right, but these are tactics. And when you are always pushing for there shouldn't be violence, you want to freeze the situation in a moment of balance that is disadvantageous to whoever is advocating the violence. So even in what seemed like a benign sort of orientation to their coverage, and one that they were unaware of as being biased, academics at least could say, well, there is a bias there that sometimes favors one side and sometimes favors another.
So now let's turn the question on NPR.
How do we determine if it has a liberal bias?
It's not so easy. We've actually talked about this a number of times. There are ways to do it, but it's going to be pretty limited. We've done some studies that look at the tone of coverage at different moments. We've done campaign coverage. The last 2 months of the 2008 campaign, I actually asked my staff today to go through that. We never broke out NPR's coverage as an independent news organization in that study, so we're running those numbers now. We did coverage of healthcare reform, and we could look and see whether NPR deviated from the norm in its use of different language on healthcare. The other thing that we did last year in our biannual consumption survey is we asked people why they went to different news outlets.
So when you go through the material you have to see if you can break out NPR's reporting on particular issues, will you share that with us?
Yes, and hopefully we'll have that very soon.
Tom, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Tom Rosensteel is the director of the Pew Research Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism. Next week, we'll talk to him about what he found. And we'll also hear from a few more of our conservative listeners. We've asked them to keep thoroughly unscientific diaries to record moments when they feel the way Sam Negus felt.
Coming up, is Stingmeister James O'Keefe a muckraker, a provocateur, or Borat?
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. Learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com. The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them. On newsstands, iPhone and iPad, and at The Economist Online. And the Park Foundation, dedicated to heightening public awareness of critical issues at parkfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Since conservative activist James O'Keefe first leaped into prominence with a series of videos that took down Acorn, he's been a polarizing figure. With his recent sting of NPR, which resulted in the forced resignation of CEO Vivian Schiller, oceans of ink have been spilled over who O'Keefe is, how he does what he does, and why. Steve Myers, managing editor of Pointer.org, says that, like it or not, O'Keefe has a lot to teach us about an emerging form of something the dictionary doesn't yet have a name for. Steve, welcome.
Hi there. Thank you.
You say that this is an emerging form of media, but there are precedents, right? I mean, O'Keefe says he's just continuing the muckraking tradition of investigative journalism.
I think there are precedents. I think this is different in some ways. O'Keefe's videos are made for the internet and the internet culture.
What's the significance of the internet here?
We are used to watching raw videos online. Even a professional news organization will put their raw video of some major news event online because people want to see the whole thing. It's a move towards transparency in a lot of ways. But by presenting raw footage of an event that appears to be unmoderated in any way by a journalist, you think that you're getting some insight into the truth, when in fact it's also an edited, crafted piece.
Okay, let's talk about what makes James O'Keefe so special. You've mentioned that his stings are a kind of reductio ad absurdum. He takes a position and he follows it until he arrives at an absurd, you say, yet logical conclusion, and that he really pioneered this in his college dining hall.
Yes, it's a really interesting story at Rutgers University. The video is still online, in which he and a couple other students sit down and they explain to a college administrator that they are members of the Irish American Heritage Association on campus.
This is a made-up group.
Yeah, I think so. I looked for any evidence of it. I couldn't find any of it. So they explain to the administrator that they're offended at the sight of the Lucky Charms box in the dining hall. They bring a cereal box and O'Keefe explains that,
as you can see, we're not all short. I mean, we have our differences of height and we think this is stereotypical.
As he said in an interview, he put them in an impossible situation. Either they're going to be insensitive to the feelings of a student group that believes in ethnic heritage, or they're going to go along with this ridiculous conclusion that Lucky Charms can't be served in the dining hall. And he says either way, they don't win.
And either way, he does. But what exactly is he winning?
His goal is to show the absurdity of this political correctness in this case.
You suggested that there really isn't a dictionary term for what he's doing, but what about undercover activism?
I think that's a good description. I also think that the word provocateur has some relevance here. What I don't want to do is to try to get too much into the debate about whether he's a journalist or not, because I think that we're going to learn more about this by just trying to identify what he does well and why it gets attention.
I get a sense that you have a kind of grudging admiration for this guy.
I think he has come up with a very good way to make his point. And I think that people who understand characteristics of media and use them to their advantage, they should get credit for that.
4 days after the release of the NPR sting tape, Glenn Beck's website, The Blaze, reported that a lot of the quotes in the edited version of the tape were taken out of context, that some remarks praising Republicans were eliminated. Why do you think that the mainstream media were so slow in reporting on the raw version of the tape? And why do you think that it was left to Glenn Beck's website, The Blaze?
The reason it was left to The Blaze to do that work is that no one else had done it, and there was a need for that work. The reason that none of us looked at it is that we were responding to the official response by NPR, and we were chasing the news and the reaction of the moment rather than going back and trying to do a little bit more work in vetting and checking into the story.
You think this form that O'Keefe is perfecting will be used with increasing regularity in the future? For one thing, he's training his own minions to do it. Do you think it'll ever become part of the mainstream reporter's toolkit?
I don't know that it matters whether mainstream journalists use it. People hear about news from third-party sources all the time now. Friends pass it along. You know, maybe they hear a radio report or they read about it on Twitter. I don't think that the public stops to think, what are the methods used to create this? And is this capital J journalism? So while I don't think that this is going to be used by mainstream media, I think that it will continue to have an impact. For Poynter's Sense-Making Project, we analyze how information goes from emerging media sources to traditional media sources and back and forth. This is a great example of how something starts in the emerging form of media, moves very quickly into traditional media, and then more reporting is done that advances the story from a non-traditional source. And I think it's fair to say that no one expected Glenn Beck's site, The Blaze, to do this work.
Steve, thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Steve Myers is the managing editor of Poynter.org.
One thing about O'Keefe's sting videos, he gets the goods. In his notorious Acorn series, local employees are seen offering suggestions about how to hide prostitution income from the government. In his NPR sting, ex-fundraiser Ron Schiller does come off at times as a pandering bigot. But along the way, misleading editing, distorted quotes, and a number of outright lies. If James O'Keefe is staging guerrilla theater to expose hypocrisy and hate, a la Sacha Baron Cohen of Borat fame, maybe that's no big deal. But Cohen is a comedian. O'Keefe claims to be practicing undercover journalism in the tradition of Mike Wallace and other venerable muckrakers. In his quest for truth, to how much untruth is he then entitled? For example, this.
On the MEAC website, it said the organization sought to, quote, spread the acceptance of Sharia across the world.
Really? That's what they said? So,
hear how unappalled Schiller was at the prospect of global Sharia law? Except he never did react that way. He'd uttered those words in response to a restaurant employee's remark about their reservation. Previously, in the teaser video for his Acorn sting, O'Keefe is seen in a ridiculous circa 1970s pimp getup, complete with chinchilla cape, cane, superfly hat, and outsized shades. He also wore the outfit in subsequent publicity appearances and left unchallenged the supposition that he'd worn it into Acorn's offices. In fact, he did no such thing. He says that's irrelevant.
This is often used by my opponent as a form of obfuscation. They say, well, you didn't wear the pimp fur inside the office. It wasn't about the pimp fur. If you see the first YouTube video, you'll see a scene at 22 seconds in where I'm walking into the office and flaxing a button down. Well, pimp protocol requires you whore out underage girls. It doesn't require the wearing of a chinchilla fur.
Why use the pimp getup in the trailer to begin with?
Many trailers and bumpers on TV and for news programs use a variety of introductions, and I wanted to, you know, do sort of a funny, sort of zany trailer that would be a prelude to these comments made by these employees. Maybe something as outrageous as their comments. I am, in fact, posing as a pimp. I am trying to help her establish a brothel and profit off of that brothel.
In fact, you didn't identify yourself as her pimp. You identified yourself as her boyfriend trying to protect her from an abusive pimp to get into the offices. And you talked about a run for Congress that you were hoping to make. It was only inside the offices that you actually started discussing with these corrupt employees the notion of importing Salvadoran women for a Chesapeake Bay brothel, correct?
That's right. In Washington, D.C., for example, I said, you know, I can use the money that the girls, the tricks from the girls perform, I can use those profits to fund my political campaign, which by definition would be pimping.
Do you mind if we now turn to the NPR sting?
Sure.
On your website, the headline is, "Watch the video, learn the truth." Then there is the pull quote from former NPR fundraiser Ron Schiller running down the Tea Party. But you took that quote out of context, didn't you? In the raw tape, which you also released, which got 1/500th of the page views that the short tape received, it's clear that in that passage, Schiller is quoting other people whom he identified as top Republicans.
I won't break a confidence, but a person who was an ambassador, so a very highly placed Republican, another person who was one of the top donors to the Republican Party, they both told me they voted for Obama, which they never believed they could ever do in their lives, that they could ever vote for a Democrat, ever. And they did because they believe that the current Republican Party is not really the Republican Party, but it's been hijacked by this group.
The radical racist Islamophobic Tea Party people?
And not just Islamophobic, but really xenophobic. I mean, basically.
Well, I think it's also clear that he's agreeing with them. In the later part of the statement, he states, it's scary. I mean, they are seriously racist people. You can certainly tell from his body language. And
but
his,
did you edit the tape and use that pull quote out of context to put the NPR executives in the worst possible light?
I don't think I did. We did release the full unedited tape along with our package, and you can try to focus in on one sentence in order to deflect from all the statements that Mr. Schiller made in order to do damage control for your friends, but the fact is that he made these egregious
James, isn't that precisely what you do? Isn't that precisely your modus?
No, I think we show these egregious statements on tape, and I don't think that anything is mitigated by that. It's a logical non sequitur for you to say, well, in the other parts of the tape, he said non-egregious things. Therefore, it exculpates him.
I didn't say that. You did. But what do you think the number one responsibility for journalists is when they edit, when they reduce, when they select? What should we be thinking about at all times when we do that?
Well, I think you should be choosing the relevant portions of the story that accurately represent the statements that were made. And what is the story? The story is the contempt and the disdain that Mr. Schiller has for Americans, for uneducated, in his words, Americans. The fact that there needs to be more educated elites, quote unquote, and the Republicans have been taken over by this Tea Party, which is characterized by this weird evangelical move. So there's this disdain.
Well, once again, you are quoting Mr. Schiller, quoting top Republicans. And by the way, on the subject of education.
That's not true. You don't have your facts straight.
Did not Mr. Schiller make a point to argue against the notion that conservatives were somehow less educated than liberals? Didn't he make a point of saying that he in no way holds that view?
Yeah, he also said that Republicans were inherently anti-intellectual and liberals more educated than conservatives. You're using a logical fallacy, focusing on something that happened that doesn't mitigate the things that do happen. And if you hold your logic up to any other reporter, if you make any other reporter live up to your own book of rules, you would completely discredit the genre of journalism. All journalists use excerpts to highlight the most egregious things made by their subjects. All Pulitzer Prize-winning journalism does that. Do you think when a reporter files a FOIA request and goes through to audit the university or the business or the publicly funded entity, he focuses on every single excerpt? Or does he focus on the excerpts that characterize the subject, on the unethical things that the subject does.
Your organization is called the Project Veritas. What does Veritas mean?
Latin for truth.
It's Latin for truth. And if you're moving tape around to even subtly alter meaning, if you're leaving out large chunks of reporting that would put an entirely different cast on reality, is that truth?
I don't agree with your assessment. I think we've been pretty accurate in the reflection of Mr. Schiller's statements, and he's even admitted he's made the statements, and we've released the full unedited tapes. Unless you can point to a specific thing in the tape that mitigates or exculpates the egregious statements made by the employee, you're just using obfuscation. You're just trying to deflect
James,
from those
statements. James, for example, there were no fewer than 6 times in raw NPR footage where Ron Schiller or his colleague took pains to tell you that, no, you cannot, for $5 million or any other sum, buy coverage on NPR. You cannot influence the news organization. And yet, that is conspicuously absent. Where you edited in his amused reaction to Sharia law, he had evinced no such amused reaction to Sharia law. In fact, it had been cut from one place and dropped in another. What is that if not obfuscation?
You're making mountains out of a molehill here. That was an introductory sequence change that broadcast journalists use all the time. But if you're going to try to mitigate all the dozen things he said by the supposed scene change of him sitting down at the table, it's a losing argument. People will see
It would be if that were the argument I'm making, but I'm not trying to mitigate anything Ron Schiller said. I'm trying to get to your tactics. So let's just recap for a moment the Acorn scenario. You lie to get into the offices. You lie subsequently about the lie you told to get into the offices. You edit the pimp shot into the trailer to create the illusion that you were somehow wearing it during your sting. You go on television wearing the same pimp outfit and let interviewers observe, uncorrected, that that's what you were wearing when you confronted the Acorn employees. If your journalistic technique is the lie, why should we believe anything you have to say?
Investigative reporters have used, quote-unquote, false pretenses, like To Catch a Predator, ABC's Primetime Live. Even Mike Wallace, at 60 Minutes, went undercover. You go undercover in order to get to the truth. Now, is it lying? It's a form of guerrilla theater. You're posing as something you're not in order to capture candid conversations from your subject. So I wouldn't characterize it as lying.
Who are your heroes?
My heroes include G.K. Chesterton, the British writer. I admire his common sense political philosophy. He's someone I really look up to. We look up to Mike Wallace at 60 Minutes. I think our methods can be considered a hybrid of many different genres, and that includes the undercover reporting of 60 Minutes and ABC News. There are elements of Gonzo. There's elements of Borat, which includes the guerrilla theater of Borat. So if you combine all these things together, I think you'll get a good sense for who we are.
Who are your enemies?
I think one of my enemies is the mainstream media. I think one of my enemies is the media which selectively edits everything and selectively edits out the truth about many things and willfully ignores subjects that they don't want to investigate. If the media was doing their job in this country, telling us the truth about public officials, telling us the truth about people, about events, we'd live in a much better world.
All right, James. Thank you very much for doing this.
You're welcome. Thank you.
James O'Keefe is founder of the Project Veritas. That was an edited version of a much longer and often contentious conversation, which can be found intact at onthemedia.org. Among the material not found in the on-air version is discussion based on our own bad information or false premises, the sort of material routinely excised from edited interviews, for obvious reasons. In addition, also in line with our standard practice, as often discussed on this show, the version you just heard involves many interior edits and even some rearrangement for the sake of clarity and brevity. However, there is another way to cut and paste, applying the black arts of broadcast editing to create an utterly dishonest impression altogether. And that might sound something like this. Who are your heroes?
G.K. Chesterton, underage prostitutes, Attorney General Jerry Brown, and hyperbole and obfuscation.
No surprises there, but who are your enemies?
I think that's something for analysts and commentators and reporters and the audience to glean for themselves.
Okay, but I'm guessing it's Buffy the Vampire Slayer, her watcher, Rupert Giles, and the whole Watchers Council. Come on. Am I right?
That's right, except for one.
So then the one you actually don't wish to see destroyed is who? Giles?
Yes, that's right. It's Giles.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Sarah Abdurrahman, Alex Goldman, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Andrew Parsons and Carlin Gallietti, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. She had help this week from Rob Granis.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.